I'm going to call this meeting of the Energy Policy Committee to order, and we do have a quorum. On today's agenda, we're learning about combined heat and power energy systems, and then we are learning about waste heat to power. And first, we have a presentation from Ken Smith from Evergreen Energy, and we'll follow the same protocol we have. We'll let Ken make his entire presentation, and then we'll ask questions at the end. So, Ken, if you want to come up and introduce yourself for the record, and then maybe say how long that you think you'll be presenting before we get to the question part.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ken Smith, President and CEO of Evergreen Energy, and I expect it'll be about 25 minutes, thereabout. Maybe I'll go a little faster than that. And so I thank you for the opportunity to you and to the committee members to present some information today on combined heat and power and waste heat recovery. And really I want to focus today is this is an efficiency conversation, and that's really going to focus a lot of my comments. You've got my presentation, I believe, is in your packet, and as well as some other information. Minnesota, I'm going to build off of the presentation you heard last week from Dr. Kushler from ACEEE, talking about the Minnesota uses a lot of energy. You have approximately 1,800 trillion BTUs of primary energy is used each year. So that's 1,800 times 10 to the 12, to give you a sense of scale, and about $21 billion is spent each year in energy in the state of Minnesota, and we import essentially all of that. So if Minnesota can use our energy more efficiently, it benefits us. It benefits our residents and our business, certainly in our economy and our environment. We've been talking about energy efficiency for a long time in this country and in this state. Going back about 40 years ago, then energy affects really every facet of our life. It affected my family in central Minnesota. Grew up on a farm outside of Staples, and when the energy crisis came, we moved from using fuel oil to wood. And you'll see a little yellow Pinto down there in the corner. My father decided that we were going to trade in our four-door Ford LTD for the family of five for a yellow Pinto, and we all had to fit in that thing, and then we fought over who was going to sit on the hump in the back of the car. So it affected all of our lives. But after 40 years of focusing on energy efficiency, you would think that we have surely made some great strides, and unfortunately we have not. In the 2011, the Department of Energy put out a report. It's called the Quadrennial Technology Review. And on page 9, you can see under energy efficiency, there was this quote, kind of buried in the report, should have been in headlines on the front. Some 60% of primary energy is lost as heat. And this is talking about the U.S. energy system. Quite a startling figure. That report then also included a full diagram that looks very much like this. I'm sure some of you have seen this kind of a flow diagram. There should be in your packet a large scale of it. I encourage you to take a look at that. Let me describe what it is. Basically, on the left-hand side is the sources of energy. It is the where energy comes from in the state. You can see solar, wind, nuclear, geothermal, natural gas, coal, petroleum, biomass. And in the middle is where the energy gets used. It's really used in three primary areas. You've seen reports on this. Where it's used in electrical generation, it's used in buildings, processes, so industrial, commercial, residential, and it's used for transportation. And then on the right-hand side is what becomes of it. And you'll see on the very right-hand side, it says rejected energy and energy services. The light gray is the rejected energy, and the dark gray is energy services. So of the primary input in the United States, roughly, and this is 2010 data, roughly 57% of it is rejected, is lost, is wasted from our nation's energy system. Approximately 43% is used. If you look at where that is happening, where does that waste heat, a lot of that is waste heat, as reported by DOE, comes from, about 47, about 48% of that comes from electrical generation. Then you have about 15.6% of it comes from facilities and processes, and about 37% of it comes from transportation. Now, we're talking about a lot of energy. This is in quadrillion. So this is 98 times 10 to the 15. That's what we're talking about, a scale. It's a lot of energy that is being wasted. Now, I got to thinking about this. We talk a lot about energy crises and what happened in the 70s and how we started making steps to move forward our energy efficiency of our nation, and we started improving our buildings, and we started improving the mileage that we get from our cars and so forth. So surely, if you look back to 1970, I thought the efficiency had to be much, much worse than it is today. If we're throwing away 57% today, what did we throw away back in 1970? This is the energy flow that from the, again, these are from Department of Energy, Livermore National Labs. And you can see in 1970, it was about 50-50. About 50% was used, and about 50% was rejected. So as an energy system, our system has actually gotten less efficient than it was in 1970. Then I took a look at the data and went back. The data that you can find from Lawrence Livermore National Labs, Department of Energy, goes back to 1950. And the top line on the slide is the rejected energy or the lost energy. The bottom line is the energy services or useful energy from 1950 to 2011, the data that's most recently available. And you can see that the gap widened. It's closed a little bit. But essentially, we have been throwing away more energy than we have used for a very long time. And the overall efficiency, then, is the line that you see, the vertical lines. And you can see it's about 42-43%. It's been the same for most of the last 15 years. So for a very long time, the U.S. energy system has remained very inefficient. Electricity generation efficiencies have remained about the same since 1960, and this certainly has created an issue. Now, when I show this slide, and I've shown these things for about the last 3 years, the question usually comes up, depending on which state I'm showing this, well, our state must be better. So is Minnesota better? No, it's really not. This is 2008 data. This was from a report published by the Department of Energy in 2011 that shows the flow diagram. They have every state. Minnesota is among them. And sadly, Minnesota is not better. About 57 in 2008, about 58% of the energy was lost. About 42.3% was actually used. So it very much mirrors the U.S. system. Electricity generation was about 32% efficient, roughly, based upon these estimates.
Yeah, I'm just going to stop you because that one slide is so hard to read. I think we have a question about the slide.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and the testifier, thank you. As you know, in our presentation here, it's a very small document, and maybe I'm just getting old, so I can't read it. Without blowing us away, can you just explain what I see? Lots of colors and lots of numbers, and I understand that waste is bad, and I get it. Can you just explain what this flow chart means? Because I can't read mine. I don't know what
it says. The very left-hand side is the various sources of energy. So you have at the top solar, then nuclear, hydro, wind, geothermal, natural gas, coal, biomass, and petroleum. So this is the amount of energy that came from those primary sources into the U.S. economy. Okay? Then you have where it goes. So you see a large black line. That's coal, and a lot of that going into electricity generation. You see a red line, the second line down. That is nuclear, and that's energy flow into electricity generation. Blue is natural gas. You can see some of the natural gas is going into electricity generation. Some of it's going to residential. Some of it's going to commercial. Some of it's going to industrial. And the bottom box is transportation. So you see a large green band that's flowing into the transportation line. And then you see then on the right-hand side where that energy goes. So the light gray is wasted energy. It's energy that is lost from the system. It doesn't create benefit. And then you have the dark gray is what they're calling it energy services over the years. It used to be called useful energy. If you go back in time and look at the DOE data, now they call it energy services is the lines that you see then on to the right. Does that help?
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I know usually you like to get through the testimony, but it doesn't really help if I'm confused for the next half hour, I guess. So, like, the example of transportation you brought up here, where you have petroleum products, it breaks out, and you have transportation about, and I think I'm reading the numbers here right, little about 40% of the quote-unquote wasted energy is from lost energy from transportation. Am I reading that correct?
Madam Chair, and sorry, don't...
Representative Smith.
Mr. Smith.
Representative, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
So transportation is about 40%.
Okay. Thank you very much.
If you then compare the 2008 data across all the states using that same flow diagrams, you can see where Minnesota lands. It's this green line here in the middle. So it's number 10 in the country. And you can see where everybody else, the line that's a horizontal line, that's at the 50% mark. So 48 out of the 50 states use less than 50% of the energy. The rest, they waste more than 50% of the energy. That's what that line is. You have two states that are using more than 50% of the energy, and that is Louisiana and Alaska. I would never have thought that Louisiana would be a bastion of energy efficiency, but apparently it is.
People at the Super Bowl would disagree, probably.
Yeah. If we look at that same data cut another way, the 2008 data that gets your comment, representative, is the 2008 data. Where is that energy lost from? Transportation is roughly 41%. Electricity generation, 37%. And you can see residential, industrial, commercial, all about the same, 7, 6, and 9% is where most of the energy is lost. Again, we're talking about in the state of Minnesota over 1,000 trillion BTUs of energy on an annual basis that's wasted. It's a tremendous amount of energy. One of the things that we look at where our energy policy is at today around energy efficiency, most of it is focused on the demand side. Most of it is focused on improving buildings and process. It's on the smallest part of where the losses are coming from. And I think that's important to know. So this certainly creates some opportunities. What are those opportunities? This is a diagram from the Department of Energy, from the National Renewable Energy Labs, and their opportunity is basically the useful heat that is rejected, that's being dumped into the environment, could be reused, could be captured and used, and that's an opportunity to put that to work back into the system. And by doing that, if we were to generate both heat and power from that waste heat, capture it, you could also capture it to generate cooling, for example, we could improve the efficiencies. So combined heat and power is one of the useful solutions that we could use it for. We could have distributed electricity generation in locations where you're actually generating electricity to the grid and taking the heat that is normally dumped and actually making beneficial use of it, which would increase the overall efficiency of the energy system and how we're using primary energy. And there's a number of benefits, which I'll get into a little bit further on. So what is combined heat and power? I know there's been some testimony on this. It's basically a method by which you simultaneously generate thermal energy, heat, and electricity. It's not really one technology. There's many technologies that do this. It can be, it's really fuel agnostic. It doesn't care. It could be from fossil fuels. It could be from renewables. And it's often in an integrated system so that I'm making the most beneficial use of that energy I possibly can. So when I'm generating electricity, perhaps that electricity is going into an industrial process, let's say a paper recycling plant, but I'm also generating the steam that can be used by that paper recycling plant. It's typically composed of mechanical components that are manufactured here in the United States. This is not a technology that we typically import. It's available here readily in the U.S., and it's a very flexible and resilient technology. One of the things that it's actually, if you think about it this way, it's a way of thinking. It's a way of how we generate energy in this country, particularly electricity, that we use, that we take the primary energy that we're using today and make as efficiently, use it as efficiently as we possibly can. How CHP works, this is one example. There's many examples of how you can generate both heat and power. In this case, where you're generating fuel into a boiler and water into a boiler, and you turn a turbine, which turns an electrical generator and generates electricity, and you're taking the waste heat that comes from that. You could generate steam, you could generate hot water, you can generate chilled water, and that could be used for an individual facility, it could be used for an individual process, it could be used for a city. So that's really the basics of what combined heat and power. You're getting two things for one. It's a way to increase efficiency. So because you are generating both heat and power, if you do it the traditional way, what we're doing now is we're generating electricity, in many cases, throwing the heat away, and then we're burning something else again to generate heat or to generate cooling. And so the DOE, this is a diagram that you can find from Department of Energy, just shows that not only do you increase the efficiency of the system, decrease the amount of primary energy that you need to have input, you actually decrease the emissions as a result. CHP comes in many sizes. This is from Department of Energy. It gives you an idea of how you could use it. So a large CHP is typically something more than 20 megawatts. It can be an industrial site, college and universities. I've seen large CHPs in that size could be for a very large campus, a hospital campus, like the Texas Medical Center, for example. Mid-sized CHP is in the 120 megawatts, and that tends to be in manufacturing assembly plants. If you look here in the Twin Cities, let's take a Rock 10 paper, for example. They've got CHP. It's about this scale. It's around 13, 14 megawatts. Institutional, military campuses, and large commercial sites and district energy systems, and some have that size and some have larger. You can also have small CHP that's on an individual building, a small commercial building, or a multifamily. It comes in a variety of sizes. And CHP can be used in a lot of locations. This is data from 2011 from the Energy Information Administration. Gives you an idea of where CHP is located. It's located throughout the country. There's many locations in Minnesota. And the table then on the right is the ranking. So you see Texas is number one in CHP. They've got 17,000 megawatts of combined heat and power. Louisiana's about 7,000 megawatts, so which might explain why their system is so efficient, is they have a lot of combined heat and power. If you look back at those states, Texas was number four in efficiency. Again, one of the states, Alaska, is number seven on this list. I think they were number three in the previous list, is where you have higher efficiency systems. So combined heat and power is used to a great extent in a number of states. In Minnesota, we have some 35, I found information, so we have 35 installations. I had in some information I could find that it had about 50. So it's in that 35 to 50 range, located throughout the state, small to large. So you've got some that are in that 20 megawatt range, and you have some of them that are in that 1 megawatt range. Total in the state of Minnesota is about 900 megawatts. So it's a good amount, but if you compare it to the states that are using a lot of combined heat and power, it's actually pretty small. What's our potential for combined heat and power? You can find a variety of information on this. The International Energy Administration has some information. You've got Department of Energy has some information. The CHP potential in Minnesota is estimated somewhere in the 3 megawatts. Information from IEA puts it in the bracket with 2,000, 8,000 megawatts. The information that I've sources from DOE and Energy Information Administration, so forth, puts the potential in Minnesota to be on more on the 2 to 3 megawatts. So today we've got about, 2 to 3,000 megawatts. So today we've got somewhere in the third of what our potential is in the state. The IEA also puts out some information on potential number of sites, and they've estimated Minnesota has that you could have sites up in the 3,000 to 10,000. That seems a little high to me as far as the number of sites. But the point is that it doesn't have to be a one-size-fits-all. And you could see CHP putting into a small community, to a large community, to a hospital or a college and university, to one individual industrial facility. When it comes to the cost of CHP, has been found to be a cost-effective electricity resource. This is actually a slide that was presented to when Department of Energy Resources was having their DG workshops. This is some of the information. I actually found this on the State of Minnesota's website. It is data from Ohio. Ohio has been increasing the amount of combined heat and power that they've been using. They've been adding to their policies to encourage these to combine heat and power. And this is information on the state of state of Ohio as to where the costs are. You can see small CHP is on the left and medium then large. And when you take into account the thermal energy that is generated, that if you take credit for that, that the cost of electricity is competitive with other technologies that could be used. There's similar data on, from other states. I found data from New Jersey that's very similar as far as what you see here from Ohio. There's many benefits to combined heat and power. It's a proven technology, improved system efficiency, diversify energy supplies, reduce emissions, increase business competitiveness. One of the things I would bring to your attention is also increases resilience and the energy security. There's been several reports. I would encourage you to Google this yourself. That if you, there's been reported in Forbes, New York Times, among others, as a result of Hurricane Sandy, where did the lights stay on? Where did the energy systems function after that kind of a massive or the superstorm? And this is just a smattering of some of the reports that were held as to where the lessons where the lights stayed on during Sandy. How CHP kept the lights on various campuses. You can find reports from Princeton University that basically the power was out, heating was out all around them, but they were on. Their campus didn't notice anything. You've got hospitals that had the same thing. There was a borough, I believe, in Queens that had the same experience as a result of having more locally based energy generation. I don't want to lose sight of also waste heat recovery. this is actually energy, as you go back to the slide I had about heat that's already in our system today, and it might be coming from power generation, it might be coming from industry. It's this stranded energy that we're already paying for, it's already into our energy system that could be used. So heat recovery generally refers to capturing waste heat from buildings or industrial site, power plant. It could be from a process. It could be from a natural gas line. And you recover that heat to generate clean thermal energy. It could be in the form of steam, hot water, chilled water. It could be for electricity generation. There's a lot of ways you can use that energy depending upon the temperature that it's being generated at. And you can use it then to vastly improve the energy efficiency that we have. One thing, too, that I would comment on, typically when we think about how our policies get written, it gets written around an individual building. What we need to start thinking about is where there is energy. So you can have one plant or a campus that they're using that energy for whatever it might be. And at the end of the day, they got excess heat. Today, we look at it, we kind of dump it. That's where it ends. There's energy maybe next door. Maybe they're in an industrial park. Somebody else could use that energy if there was policy and so forth to encourage that. So I think we need to think differently about energy and stop thinking at the four walls of our building or at the property lines to what is around us and how can we use this energy more efficiently and more effectively. Again, I mentioned how it can be used. There's some examples, heating and cooling. Snow melt, you have an example over in Hennepin County that they're going to take waste heat from HERC and use that to snow melt platforms, transit platforms, generate electricity. There's a lot of ways this energy can be used that it's currently not today. Who's encouraging combined heat and power and recovery of waste heat? Many folks. This is just a smattering. If you Google it, you'll find that the use of combined heat and power, cogeneration, heat recovery is growing. It's not just growing in the United States. It's growing globally. It's growing in countries that have abundant energy. Canada. It's growing in Canada. It's growing in Australia. And it's growing in places where they don't have abundant energy, for example, in Germany. So there's many places where combined heat and power is being used as part of their portfolio of how they're going to position their energy system for the future. Just briefly on policy landscape, Minnesota, this is an ACEEE report on energy policy in general. Ranks Minnesota 9th best. This is the most recent scorecard, I think it's 2012. But if you look at the detail, Minnesota combined heat and power policy lags other states. We get a score of 1 out of 5. On the next page, what I've included is where that scoring is at. So we get a half a point for interconnection rules and a half point for waste heat recovery. Actually, in the state of Minnesota standards, heat recovery to generate electricity is in our SIP legislation, but it stops there. And you can see that we didn't score in any of the other categories. You will see, too, that like output-based emissions and so forth, you can see states that are doing much more, and I've given you kind of the average of the top 10 states and what they are doing. The next slide is example of what some other states are doing. As I mentioned, Texas has been very active in this space. Ohio's been very active. California recently passed legislation. That's just an example of what's going on. You're seeing increased activity in a number of states. North Carolina has energy policy for CHP, Massachusetts, and so forth. There should be in your packet, I hope, because we brought it over, should be information on a report from CHP policy from EPA. It's a partnership between the Department of Energy and CHP. If that's not in your packet, I'll make sure to get that to you. It basically compares the policies across all of the states and what they have in various categories. So Minnesota, if we look to the future, Minnesota will add generation. We're going to add natural gas-fired plants. And I would encourage us to think maybe a little differently and say that that provides us an opportunity to install combined heat and power. Perhaps it gives us an opportunity to install more distributed combined heat and power in smaller communities, Minsky campuses, where we have load aggregated that we could actually use the thermal energy and the electricity, or industry, for example. It also gives us an opportunity to think that we can do large combined cycle, combined heat and power. I've got in the packet, I've put a picture. This is actually a new turbine that's been developed by Siemens. This is going to go into Dusseldorf, Germany. It's a 600 megawatt unit. It's going to be combined cycle, combined heat and power. They're integrating the waste heat into a district energy system. You're starting to see that now being rolled out around the world. In this case, the plant was going to have an efficiency of 61%. Again, this is just the most advanced combined cycle technology. But because they're going to integrate that and use the waste heat, the efficiency of that plant is going to be over 85%. So significant improvement. So just to wrap up, Minnesota current energy system wastes over 50% of our primary energy. Nearly all of our energy is imported. Most of the energy that is lost is heat. So we should look for opportunities to use the waste heat we already have to improve the efficiency of our system and reduce the amount of energy that we use. The second thing is I would encourage you is to look for ways to avoid adding to the problem. So if we're going to add generation, we're going to add new generation, let's look for ways to make it as efficient as we possibly can and utilize the input energy as effectively as we possibly can and take that waste heat and put it to work into our communities, our businesses. It's basically carbon-free and certainly could be cost-effective if done properly. With that, any questions?
Thank you. And members, we're going to email. There's an EPA report that just came out that kind of evaluates the different policy proposals that the 50 states are doing in this area. Some states have done something in the renewable energy standard. Other states have done something in their conservation standard. And the report is actually pretty short. It's pretty dense, but it gives you an idea of the different directions we could go in this area. And the reason I had Ken come and present to the committee today is I think we'll be looking at some legislation in this area, and I'm hopeful it's an area we can work together to figure out a way to not be just wasting energy. So questions. We'll do questions until about 1:20, and then we'll turn to our second presenter, and they'll present for about 20 minutes, and we'll do 20 minutes of questions there. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would hope that we could get a PDF that we could blow up so we could look at some of these slides in more detail. I, along with what Representative Garofalo was bringing up in the more complex slides, the point that a large portion of the lost energy is out the tailpipe.
Right.
Looking at residential, even though electricity is less than 30%, you've got 35%. Inefficiency, you know, lost heat. I'm assuming that's part of Minnesota's hit is because we live in the northern climate and we actually use energy to heat our homes, so there's loss there. Inefficiency of light bulbs. I mean, you're talking about generation, but were there any comments coming out of these reports that were efficiencies at the point of use, industrial, residential, commercial?
Well,
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair and Representative, basically when it comes to electricity generation in the country, the average is 32-33%. So it's no better, no worse in the state of Minnesota. Because we use more energy, certainly you're going to see more losses. When it comes to residential, for example, it's going to be the building stock that we have that gets to the codes that we have, but you also have older building stock too, so to the extent that you're using it in those homes. When it comes to transportation, when I've looked at the data, Minnesota tends to be higher than other states, and I've tried to think why that is. And if I think about it, we're a cold weather state, and my own experiences are when it's cold, I don't get as good a gas mileage. And then sometimes I got to leave my car run to warm it up. And so I think what we're seeing is the transportation is there's more losses there in our state because of the climate that we are in. But when it comes to the balance, if we were to compare percentages, say, of residential and the losses that we would have, my guess is we're losing more energy just because we have more energy input. For example, it's also in the commercial and industrial.
Representative Palm, did you have a follow-up? Or?
No, I'm good at this time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein, and the one question I would ask, and maybe this is Representative Hornstein's question, is it because we have less transit here in that transportation sector? As you were talking about the cars warming up, I was also thinking about other cities and how they compare with their transit systems.
Madam Chair, you are such a mind reader. No,
sorry.
No, and I mean, it's interesting that we have, you know, between Representative Garofalo and Representative Palm, myself, the comments of the chair on the transportation issue, because, you know, even though we're talking about electricity, you laid out some solutions to that problem,
right?
You know, with coal plants and others. What ideas do you have about how to deal with this 40% waste in the transportation sector as a solution.
Madam Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a tough one. Is it because of transit? I don't know. I didn't compare the states. I do know if you look at the big picture comparing the states, there are states in warm weather climates that not necessarily because of they have transit that tend to use less, they have less losses than what we do in the state of Minnesota on transit or on transportation. One challenge I see is by electrifying our electricity or our transportation. I do have some concern that if you're going to put it on a grid that's 33% efficient. So I need to think, we need to think about that. But I, you know, is it mileage? Is it the type of transportation we're using? I'm probably not the best expert to comment on that, sir.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, but you certainly got our attention, and I think that's a good thing.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, so if I understand your testimony correctly, you say that CHP saves money, is more efficient, and is good for the environment, correct?
Yes, sir.
And Madam Chair, and to the testifier, if that's the if those things are true, why do we have to tell power generators to they have to do this? It would seem that if that's correct, that they would, if it really does save money and does all these things, they would just do it. You don't need to tell me to drive with my windows rolled up when it's 10 below outside. I just figure that out, and it seems kind of, assuming your statements are correct, so why do we need to tell power generators to do this?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's a very good question. And you're seeing this across the country. In general, we have a framework for our energy system that we put the generation outside of our communities and we build big. And I think in part because it's probably easier to get it permitted outside of where the low density is at. Do the utilities know this? I would expect that they do. I've shared this with a number of them. But it's really around a policy framework, I believe, is part of it. We're not encouraging this to be done. Now, if you look at Louisiana and Texas, it kind of surprised me that they popped up as high as they did. But most of that combined heat and power is for industrial. I go back in the data because I thought, well, it's not showing up in the electricity generation because the efficiency of the electricity generation, as far as the flow charts, is about the same. But what they are doing is they're using combined heat and power for industry. And that makes a lot of sense. It's because you have the low density there. I can generate both the thermal energy that I need for a process, and I can also generate the electricity that I need. So that's a tough question, sir. I come across this in a lot of states. It is one of the low-hanging fruit that we have. It's just not an area that we have concentrated on as a country. And I think in part I can tell you that I've shown these flow diagrams for the past 3 years to, well in excess of 1,000 people. It's many more than that. And I've had very few people that are aware of it from this perspective. Our policies tend to be focused on the pieces rather than on the system. We tend to focus policy that are on making our buildings efficient but not looking at the overall system. I think that's part of it. It's just how we view energy.
Representative Garofalo.
And Madam Chair, just I apologize for the question that may come across as from being from a novice, but it seems to me that there's two different ways to do this. One of them is to recapture it and then feed it back into the system to make the power generation more efficient. The second way is to capture this and distribute it out to actually use it for heat. Mm-hmm. Is that correct, or am I misunderstanding it?
You certainly, Madam Chair and Representative, you certainly can. That's what you have in a combined cycle power plant, for example, a natural gas-fired power plant. You're burning the natural gas, you're generating steam, you're putting it through a turbine, right? And I'm generating electricity, and I still have energy that's left. And then I'm putting in what's called a HRSG, a heat recovery steam generator. I'm generating some more electricity. Could you squeeze some more out of it? I am sure there's some technologies to do that. And so the combined cycle power plants, the efficiency of them compared to a coal plant, much higher. I mean, the newer plants that have been installed in the state of Minnesota are in the 50-55% efficient. But at the end of the day, as you squeeze more and more of the energy, it has higher and higher or lower and lower value for power generation. But there's still a lot of energy there that could be used to heat and cool homes or processes. So it's just as it goes down through the chain, you get the steam has less pressure and less temperature, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have a lot of energy yet.
Thank you.
This might be a good time to point out that the Capitol complex is heated and cooled from a combined heat and power system. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Smith, I assume the initial investment is the detriment to it or not, or gives people pause. So I would, my first question is just what is the projected payback on the initial investment on this?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, that depends on a lot of factors. You would have to look at where you're going to use, if you have value for the thermal energy, what is the price of electricity that you're maybe offsetting, for example, in an industrial facility. There's not a one-size-fits-all answer on that. I could share with you some information. I thought about putting it in here that I have found that shows kind of the cost per megawatt for various capital investments for this, the small to large size is kind of a band, but it tends to be pretty cost effective, again, depending on the fuel source and depending upon are you using the thermal energy, what kind of revenue are you getting for that, what are you getting for the electricity, are you using it all on site or you are actually going to export it to the system. You also get in situations where if you have electricity generation on site, the utilities will say that, well, if that's not there, I've got to have, there's a standby charge, basically. There's a charge to if it fails. But you'll find that combined heat and power is actually among some of your most reliable power generation. So I'm sorry, I can't give you just a number, but there's a lot of factors depending upon the installation that you would put in. I could send you some information that gives you some general guidelines, but it's really site-specific.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Mr. Smith, that goes really to my next question, because assuming that there is some payback time period, I would assume years, that would only suggest then that it would need to be running on a constant basis, which would suggest, I mean, you indicated that it would be fuel agnostic, but to me that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because if it's not running on a continual basis, suggesting baseload power, suggesting fossil fuel, then I can't imagine that it would be as efficient with renewable. Would that be safe to assume?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends upon the fuel that you're using. You certainly can use solid fuels like wood, for example, to generate electricity, and depending if it's available. You do have many instances where you can install fossil fuels as a fuel source. Certainly, the more hours that you can run it, the better. So base load is good, rather than it's kind of cycling off and on. So base load for combined heat and power is a good thing. But I can tell you, too, that depending upon the structure of which how your electricity system is set up, for example, in Canada, where they have more of a market-based approach, they're running their combined heat and power base load, but when the electricity prices are higher, they're generating more electricity and less thermal, and when it's lower, they're generating more thermal and less electricity, but they are generating because that's where they create the cash flow for it. You're also talking about infrastructure that is 20, 30 plus years. I mean, this is equipment that is a long-term investment.
Representative Kelly.
Just one more follow-up, Madam Chair. Mr. Smith, it seems to be most efficient, I guess. That's what I would, that's where I was going. And my assumption would be that in it's possible then we could actually be creating a more of a dependency on our fossil fuel as opposed to trying to lean, as we've seen a lot of the discussion here on the renewable energy stream, Madam Chair. But one last question is, what is the plant in Dusseldorf? Will that primary power supply be?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's going to be natural gas.
Thank you.
That's a natural gas plant.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Smith, I got a couple other comments to make, but you just spurred a question. The plant that you run at District Energy, 25 megs of electricity, 60-some of steam, district heat. Do you manage, what's your primary focus? Do you got to keep the buildings warm first, or do you generate to the power grid first?
Mr. Smith.
Can you talk about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, yes. It's both. there is a contract to provide the electricity, so you got to provide the electricity.
Okay.
And so that's there's a contractual obligation. There's also a contractual obligation to provide the hot water or the steam that just generates the hot water. But it depends. You've got to meet your contractual obligations at both ends. And in particular, I would say electricity probably drives that because you've got to meet the 25 megawatts.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I understand, I'm sorry I missed the tour, Mr. Smith. I've got to come back, and I'm looking at your lobbyist saying, get me back on the list to see this place. But as I understand, you can push heat out about 8 miles, but you can only push cold water about 3 for cooling purposes. Is that right?
That's roughly we have about 20 miles of hot water piping. But hot water can be piped miles and miles and miles. There are systems, particularly in Europe, that are in excess of 40 and 50 miles of hot water piping. And so in particular, you can have an existing power plant that they're now capturing the heat and bringing it into a city that's being looked at in the UK, for example, outside of London. There are instances where you have multiple cities tied together with what's called, it's called a transmission line. You're transmitting thermal energy across that grid, and multiple plants are connecting into it.
Representative.
On chilled water, you don't go as far. In part, on hot water, you're putting it on as much higher temperatures, and so you're putting it at like 250 degrees. That's the system downtown, and you work off of a 90-degree delta T. You can put a lot of energy in that amount of temperature range. In chilled water, you're putting it out at 42 degrees, and you're looking back around a 15, 16, 17-degree delta T. So you got to move a lot more water to move the thermal energy, and you just don't go as far. The pipes get really big really fast.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's important to know about how far you can push it, because when we're trying to do combined heat and so on, there are some physical limitations to what we can do. Your comments about siting baseload power plants, we generally don't put them in neighborhoods, is telling as to why we don't do what we do or why we haven't done it to this point. But we did at one time, the King plant in Bayport, and I don't think I'm telling tales out of school, they used to supply almost all the steam for Anderson Windows. The renewable energy standard, I think, caught us there, because Anderson switched to burning their own wood waste and dropped the contract with the King plant, which we may want to discuss one of these days as to what was whether we got at cross purposes with ourselves. The other one was the High Bridge plant, kept Rock 10 in business for years and years, and when we dropped when we gasified the High Bridge plant, the combined cycle arrangement they put in there, which is a marvelous piece of machinery, was not capable of supplying the steam that Rock 10 needed, which put us into another conundrum we had to fix, and I guess they've worked it out down there. They're keeping that working, but just know that things we do here sometimes have unintended consequences, and they can be challenging, but we can work our way through them. The intermittent power too, I just want to speak about the combined cycle. They've become intermittent plants, and that's been a big problem. Rock 10 needed steam 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, when they run the High Bridge plant on the coldest days and the hottest days, it's kind of hard to make cardboard whenever your steam may or may not be there. So that gets to be a challenge as well. Just an observation about Louisiana and Texas, Madam Chair. That's the chemical coast. And coast siting power plants with huge consumers of heat and electricity makes a lot of sense there. And I can see why that would drive that efficiency. There are power plants, there are refineries, there are chemical factories all along that coast. And they don't waste much of anything down there. Mr. Smith, I do have a question for you, because just in sitting here thinking about, if I ran a coal plant was only getting 31% of the BTUs going out as some sort of revenue, and that's a lot of BTUs, if I could move it up 3 or 4 points, I'd be knocking myself out to do that. So it's not like these guys are being derelict in their duty. What are we up against here with just increasing the efficiency that can't move this needle 35 or 40 before we even getting into combined heat and cycle? And I have a hunch it has something to do with the requirement to convert the steam back to liquid water before we run it through again. Can you talk and enlighten the committee a little bit about that?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair and Representative Beard, there is a technology limitation at a coal plant. And so it's really the technology that's there. It's not that you still don't have some energy that could be used, converting it back to the condensing side of it, and what you do with that energy is certainly a part of it. I do want to talk to one thing. If you talked about Texas and Louisiana, which goes to the point, in order to increase the efficiency, we need to look at how do we integrate our solutions together. Mm-hmm. And so you're right on point there that, and yes, you have the chemical coast of Minnesota, but we have opportunities to integrate our energy system here much more so in the future. And to the extent that we can improve just a 1, 2, 3% efficiency, we're talking a tremendous amount of energy that could actually really benefit our economy here in Minnesota, since we import so much of it.
Thank you. And Representative Beard, I think your observation about the Anderson Windows King plant is exactly the policy question that we should ask, and that I think bills that we could consider would look at. So thank you for presenting, and we're going to move on to our next presenter, Tony Strachwadine?
Strachwadine.
Strachwadine from Alliance Pipeline. And we'll have you present till about 22 and then switch over to questions if that works.
That'd be
22,
great.
Quarter to.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the House Energy Policy Committee. I'm Tony Strachwadine. I lead the government affairs function for Alliance Pipeline, headquartered here in Eden Prairie. Many of you may not know there's a significant natural gas pipeline that imports gas from Canada as well as North Dakota through the state of Minnesota based in Eden Prairie. I also represent NR Green Power, which is a small waste heat to power company based out of Canada. We'll talk about how that might work in some of the policy decisions that you all might consider in the course of the session. And I'm also the chair of the National Heat is Power Association that looks at this specific context of how do you capture heat from existing industrial facilities and generate a useful product out of it, emissions-free electricity. So I'll describe what the Heat is Power Association does. I'll talk about the NR Green and Alliance Pipeline. Why is that significant? Why do they work together overall? I'll introduce a little bit of the technology very briefly. I think Ken's done a nice job in talking about some of that. I will specifically talk to, though, the notion of capturing the heat. We are agnostic to the energy source to create that heat, but what happens or how do you best turn that into efficient electricity from there, and then talk about some of the development challenges both in the U.S. overall as well as here in Minnesota. I have had discussions with the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, John Wellinghoff, who is very passionate about energy efficiency and is very interested in further development of waste heat to power opportunities in the nation. So we look at the Heat is Power Association. It is a nationwide trade association focused on the ability to take waste heat and create useful power in the U.S. We promote the efficient industrial use of emissions-free electricity generated through waste heat to power processes. It's an interesting organization. It's fairly new. It's only a couple of years old. As we look at some of the issues that we focus on is what are states doing in these areas? What's federal policy driving around that? Madam Chair, you mentioned the EPA study that recently came out. There's also the Department of Energy's looked at these topics as well. As we look at, there's 14 states today that recognize or support waste heat to power in one form or another, whether it's the equivalent of or qualifying for their renewable energy portfolio, whether it's other mechanisms or incentive programs, or whether, as Minnesota has recognized, when we were able to add this to the conservation improvement program here in the state in the past. I also want to point out that Ohio recently added waste heat to their efficiency and renewable portfolio standards. I actually testified in front of the Senate on that bill specifically to drive this on behalf of the Heat to Power Association itself. We have a variety of members, as you can see, some small manufacturers, some project developers, and some significant entities such as General Electric and Pratt & Whitney overall. So we're very active in trying to work across the space itself. In the material that I've handed out to you, you'll also find a copy of an executive order that President Obama issued in August 30th supporting increased use of industrial energy efficiency, including waste heat to power. He's looking to drive a goal of 40 gigawatts of new electricity from these sources. And as I mentioned, the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission supports this. As we jump to NR Green Power, which is a company that's based out of Canada that's generated these types of projects or put together these projects, which are essentially a type of combined heat and power. It's also referred to as bottoming cycle, which means it takes whatever heat is produced and generates electricity from there. This company was set up in 2002, and we've been able to commercialize and put four plants that yesterday generated about 475 megawatts in Saskatchewan, specifically. It is a privately held entity. It's important to note that the NR Green Power facilities basically buy their heat from the Alliance Pipeline facilities. Alliance Pipeline is an interstate natural gas pipeline that imports about 1.6 billion cubic feet of natural gas every day from Canada into the U.S. We're now connected to the North Dakota Bakken fields that brings in about 110, we're expanding to about 250 million cubic feet of natural gas from North Dakota in the next year. Each of these compressor stations that push the gas along are 31,000 horsepower jet engines, basically, GE jet engines that compress and push the gas down to the next station. Those are simple cycle, as they're termed, or in other words, a jet that simply turns a compressor that drives the gas down. There's heat as a result of the combustion of natural gas, which is our fuel source there. All the emissions are accounted for under the pipeline permits, under the air quality permits, and will continue to be accounted for there overall. Those units operate 98% of the time. It's important that, this is baseload opportunity to generate new electricity with no greenhouse gas or no incremental emissions, no additional fuel. We also would argue, and this is recognized in Canada, that each of these stations avoids 55,000 tons of greenhouse gas equivalent emissions per year based on the ability to capture that heat and make electricity from there. This technology can be applied to any industrial facility, whether it's a pipeline, whether it's a pulp and paper mill, steel mills, etc. There's a couple of examples of utilizing waste heat from facilities in the Chicago market, surprisingly, as well. This is baseload power. The Alliance Pipeline system gets paid when it transports gas, so our units are operating 98% of the time. That is a tremendous opportunity to backstop other intermittent sources overall. And this electricity can be scaled for whether it goes out as a distribution load level voltages or under the transmission voltages overall. It's all how you develop your transformers to meet the grid requirements. This is innovative technology, if you will, capturing that heat through a combined heat, looking at it as two different loops. This is the current technology that we utilize in Saskatchewan, which is an organic Rankine cycle. So if you look at the tubes, it's all combined there. We have mineral oil that's warmed by the exhaust from the compressors. That transfers that heat to another loop of a motive fluid, which in this case is pentane, which then turns to a gas, which turns the electric generator. Then that pentane is cooled down through a cooling process and repeat the overall cycle. So it's combined, it's all isolated, there's no water utilization itself. The second diagram that you have in your package is an innovative process that General Electric will have their first facility called Origin Technology that they will apply to a compressor station in Alberta. This is a unique approach in that they can generate up to 14 megawatt hours from this station based on the ability to take that heat that the compressors put out and turn through a turbo expander the ability to generate that electricity. Again, similar cycle to what you saw previously. In Saskatchewan, we've been successful in developing four stations on the Alliance Pipeline system since 2006 for the first, the others in 2008. We sell that power back to the grid. It's not a net metering operation because it's too much electricity. 5 megawatts per hour are generated at each of these sites. They are rural, so it's distributed energy generation. We both backstop the grid as well as fill in deficiencies that the utility there, SAS Power, has in the area. And the utility recognizes the environmental benefits because there is a cost of carbon in Saskatchewan today. They have some targets to reduce their emissions over time, and so they'll pay a premium for those emissions as well that we're able to offset. It's been safe. It's monitored remotely as well as locally. There's long-term power purchase agreements. Each site generates or is equivalent of 5.4 megawatts per hour. This is a picture of the facility. These are similar to each and every one of the compressor stations that we have along the Alliance Pipeline system. What you'll see is The building is where the compressor, the jet engine is housed, and the related equipment to compress the gas to push it down the system. We add the additional stack that puts the heat through, which goes through the heating tubes, ultimately turns a generator. Over on the right side of the picture, you'll see where the actual recuperating units are that take the pentane from a gas back to a liquid. And then in the middle is what I call the cash register, the transformers that go out on the electric lines onto the grid itself. As I mentioned, Alberta, there's a new facility we're putting in with the GE technology, 14 megawatts being generated from that station. The difference is we have three 40,000 horsepower jets working, of which two are always operating as the head station on the Alliance Pipeline system. Alberta is a deregulated market versus Saskatchewan is a Crown Corp or a state-owned utility market, so a little different dynamics there, more risk for us to take on. But we were able to qualify for a grant from the Technology Fund, which is the compliance technique in, or one of the compliance techniques for reducing greenhouse gases in Alberta. So the Climate Change Emissions Management Corporation granted a $7 million fund to this project, and we're able to commercialize it and put it in service later this year. So you'll see the three compressor buildings, but two are always operating. The facility at the top is actually where we're building that waste heat facility to capture and generate that electricity to go out onto the grid there in Alberta. We're looking at both long-term power purchase agreement side as well as some offsets onto the grid itself. As I mentioned, it's a deregulated market.
Madam Chair, to this point, slide right here. I want to thank the testifier. We were wondering when we would see a solar plant at night. So thank you very much for showing that to us.
Now I have to try to say the testifier's last name to
well, I was
put the
to
ball
show
back
a video
in his
at this
court.
Point, but I'm not sure. Can you get it to work for me? It's a 2-minute video, so bear with us while we.
Thank you. It's not a solar plant.
This just gives you an example of the technology that we're applying there in Alberta. We have two other stations in Alberta that we've applied for funding to help offset. Why don't these, I guess to anticipate the question, why aren't these projects developed today? Well, the Alliance Pipeline system has a need to push gas down its system. Simple cycle is simply the way to do that. That's efficiency. The shippers pay for the gas. We don't own the energy. We simply transport it. So as a result,
the Alliance Pipeline is a transmission system that runs from Northeast BC to Chicago. Alliance Pipeline transports about 1.6 BCF of natural gas per day.
Along the Alliance Pipeline system, approximately every 200 kilometers, there's a gas compressor that is driven by a gas turbine. Energreen Power is a sister company to Alliance Pipeline.
Energreen Power is a small company focused on recovered energy generation from waste heat sources. We take that high temperature energy and turn it into electricity.
The Origin technology does not require any additional makeup water. In an application about this size, that would mean about 11,000 cubic meters of water every year, or enough to fill about 4 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
The Origin technology is good for use in remote locations, and it's fully automated and be able to operate and remotely supervise it from a distance.
So that's one of the reasons why we're so interested in working with GE. It has been a very good relationship, so we continue to strengthen that collaborative relationship. The other thing to consider when you're looking at application technology is the environment you're going to be in. In our case, I can see very large swings in ambient temperatures, from minus 45 degrees C up to plus 35 degrees C.
This facility will produce about 14 megawatts electricity.
Now, just to put that in perspective, 14 megawatts is enough for about 14,000 average homes. So when you can develop a power project that does not require water makeup and has no additional emissions, then this is the type of project we're after. Through our collaboration with GE and the Evolutions technology, it is our goal to generate even more clean energy.
So with this, they are expensive projects in which to put in place. As you look at the Minnesota opportunities, we have two compressor stations here in the state that we could apply this to through the NR Green company outside of the regulated pipeline company. Each could create 5 new jobs. 6 megawatts per station is the capability based on the latest technology. Up to about 200,000 megawatts per year could be created, enough for roughly 52,000 homes, and a big offset of 110,000 tons of GHG equivalent. Key here is this represents about a $100 million capital investment, so it's a risk outside the pipeline side. That's why we've set up the NR Green Power Company itself. Challenges that we have in the U.S., Minnesota is part of that as well, is that the waste heat is not on a level playing field with other generation, specifically other emission-free power. We would like to be considered an equivalent of other policy or other renewables, perhaps. Also, waste heat is not under the current federal PURPA regulations, the utility regulations itself, or does it qualify under the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, the federal regulations. There's also some perception of concerns around having a facility associated with a FERC-regulated pipeline on separating the revenue and income from what the pipeline business is versus the heat side. We think we can manage that with the chairman of FERC. And then there's also the lack of demand and the interconnect challenges at times relative to the generation itself. What might Minnesota consider relative to policy to support this is to include it into a portfolio standard or other equivalents. Are there ways in which to stimulate demand or interest from the utilities that this is a great way to fill in deficiencies in their grid or to offset other emissions or greenhouse gas concerns that you might have? And then finally, you know, is it a qualified technology to the other equivalent generations that are currently recognized in the state? So are there incentives or programs that can be put in place? In closing, the NR Green Power and the Heat is Power Association is interested in moving efficient use of industrial heat sources. This is one capability that we certainly could generate electricity here in the state. It is a challenge from a capital intensity and a payback side of things, but there's great electricity generation as a baseload power. With that, I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Right now, Representative Morgan, are you prepared to move the minutes from the last two meetings?
If you insist, Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes from February 4th and February 5th meetings. Thank you.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those
aye.
Opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Questions to the testifier, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I just call you Tony?
Yes, sir.
It's good to see you again, by the way. I'm glad you're here. I'm looking at your slide on slide 18 on page 9. You're talking about $100 million of capital investment for 2 6 megawatt. Is this for the two, when Olivia and Albert Lea? Is that what you're projecting?
That is correct.
Madam Chair,
Representative, that's correct. It's expensive.
Yeah, because I'm used to, you know, wind, a buck a watt, combined cycle that the power plants build, maybe two. How in the world do we, can you tell us why they're so expensive?
Madam Chair,
if you can,
Representative Bear, it's expensive to retrofit the stations, which are built as a simple cycle, mm-hmm. add the equipment, be able then to take the risk. The interconnect costs also can be expensive as well. So it's a variety of the equipment manufacturers that we utilize or been able to use. Some started in the geothermal fields, and they've been able to do some cost-effective side with that, but it is an expensive overall project.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I love the concept here. Just I'm looking at that number and thinking, wowzers, what the... hear a little more about that. Maybe I'm way off in my estimates of what it costs to retrofit some of the old coal plants we've updated, but I did notice that jumped right out at me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Tony. What sort of, you know, since you have no fuel costs, what sort of payback in years would you look for the investment and outlay?
I'm going to call you what high school students would call you if you were their teacher, Mr. S. Mr. S.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, our owners look at a payback between 10 and 15 years relative to how do they recoup this, recognizing that it's separate risk capital. Step back, the pipeline itself is essentially looks at a 40-year payback. It was a $5 billion project when we built it originally. So because this is a separate risk investment that the owners put or consider overall, we look at anywhere of 10 to 15 year payback.
Representative Quam. Representative Kelly, do you have a question?
That was a question. Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier? If we don't have, Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does that capital investment include replacing any of the existing equipment that's used for compressing the gas currently, or does it just tie into that equipment?
Mr. Strakewedine.
Madam Chair, Representative, it is the capital investment recognizes new equipment specifically for the waste heat to power generation application. There is no changes to the existing facility other than putting the new stack in place, but that benefits the waste heat power generation mm-hmm. approach.
Thank you. Representative Yaruso. All right, members, if there's no more questions, I wanted to call your attention to something we put in the packet. Mr. Eliff worked on a list of common energy acronyms for us. I hope PURPA's in there. I think PURPA's in there. So take a look at that. Put it in your save section if you want to hang on to it. And then our committee administrator is working on putting all the documents that we've received electronically up linked in the agenda on our website. So if you go to the Energy Committee website and you click on the minutes for any of the dates we've met, you'll be able to get the presentation. So for those of you who'd like to see a larger copy of the Lawrence Livermore National Lab diagram that Mr. Smith used, you'll be able to see that on your computer screen at whatever size you'd like by going to the Energy Committee website. And if there's no more business before the committee today, this meeting is adjourned.